morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Eswatini's government denies security forces shot and killed protesters.
The reports we have currently is that there is no one who has been killed by the security forces or by the police specifically since the protest that we experienced yesterday in some parts of the country.
Meanwhile, more groups are joining the protest movement in Eswatini. A boat with more than 400 Africans rescued at sea is looking for a port to enter Europe. A group of mixed-race women abducted as children in what was then Belgian Congo is suing the Belgian government for crimes against humanity. And Botswana is processing 100 DRC refugees who fled a refugee camp in Zimbabwe.
The government of Botswana agrees that the best durable solution for refugees is for them to return to their countries of origin. We believe that returns must be voluntary, safe, and dignified.
And 5.9 million people in Somalia require immediate humanitarian help. Those stories plus Samson Omali's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The government of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, says no one was killed by security forces during the latest of the ongoing protests by students, public transport workers, and civil society who are demanding democratic reforms and the release of two jailed members of parliament. Latest reports say one person was killed and at least 80 people wounded during Wednesday's protest. However, government spokesperson Sibelo Dlamini says one person was shot in the thigh by security forces using rubber bullets. He also says two others were shot and wounded, not by police, but by unknown motorists, as the two were blocking the road and illegally collecting tolls.
The reports we have currently is that there is no one who has been killed by the security forces or by the police specifically since the protest that we experienced yesterday in some parts of the country. The reports we have from the police, which are still being collated, is that one person was shot by a rubber bullet on their foot in the city of Manzini and got injured. Other people were affected by the tear gas which police were using to disperse protesters in both cities, Manzini and Babane. And we have other two incidences of people who were shot, but they were shot by a private citizen who was protecting himself from an unruly group that was attacking him.
We know that schools in Eswatini are closed now. Again, the students have been protesting because the people of your country, they say they want democracy, participation in the selection of their own prime minister. What happens now? What does the country do when you have schools closed?
Let me start by explaining this, James. Eswatini is a democratic state. Eswatini has a constitution which has all the tenets of democracy. The same constitution provides the provisions and procedures and modes when people want to propose any changes to governance issues or to any provisions of the constitution. Like any other country, we respect the rule of law. And as a result, we expect everybody to follow the constitution whenever they have ideas or suggestions about any changes they will want to infuse in the constitution or in the issues of governance. Yes, we've had protests of students. Unfortunately, a number of schools have been affected. Some schools have been banned. As a result, government took a decision to close schools, to suspend the operation of schools for now until peace is restored, just to protect students.
But does the government believe that closing schools is a solution? Because I think the student protest is about the two members of parliament who are detained, and I think their trial has started already. They want those two members of parliament to be released.
Our constitution, James, provides separation of powers. We have the judiciary, we have the legislature, we have the executive. So issues that are being dealt with by the judiciary, we cannot comment on them as an executive because the courts are independent in this country. So it is an issue I cannot delve into. But yes, government hopes that schools will be opening very soon because the more they are closed, we know that the education of our children will be affected severely, even in the future. So government is looking around the clock to ensure that schools open. But what is very critical is that when they open safely and all children are protected as they go on to class.
I read an article that I think is the King Mswati III, who is requesting mobile carriers to block or suspend Facebook in the face of these protests.
That is not true, James. This was a government decision, not any order from His Majesty. Government took that decision based on intelligence reports of security threats to the nation, to businesses, to private citizens, and nothing more. But internet is now back and fully functional, James.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure, James.
Sabalo Dlamini is the acting spokesperson for the Eswatini or Swaziland government. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. In Eswatini, the political party assembly, the PPA, an umbrella group of parties, says it will join civil society groups to defy announced plans to ban all protests and demonstrations in the Southern African Kingdom. Eswatini students have been protesting to demand democratic reforms and the release of two members of parliament who the protesters say were detained because they called for democratic reforms. Meanwhile, local media reports say countries in the region have deployed envoys to Eswatini to help reduce the tension and violence. Mbangi Seni Shabangu is the leading member of the PPA and the general secretary of the Swaziland Democratic Party. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the only way to resolve the ongoing political crisis is to ensure democratic reforms that will enable the citizens to choose their own leaders.
Most civil society have decided they're going to defy this, because the biggest law in the land is the Constitution with a Bill of Rights, where Article 24 gives the citizens the right to express themselves. And also Article 25 of the same document, which allows for people to assembly freely. Until you deal with those two articles, you cannot come overnight and revoke that without any legal basis.
But in Mbokisini, the Southern African countries have deployed envoys to Eswatini to try to stem the unrest that has seen one person killed and at least 80 people injured in the recent wave of pro-democracy protests. What are your expectations of this?
As long as it's going to include civil society and political parties, Peter, it's going to be futile and useless. Most of the time, their entry point is the state, which tells them their side of the story. Most of the time, they don't give quality time to the dissenting voices. But I hope for the best. I don't want to rubbish the attempt by President Cyril Ramaphosa, but at the same time, as political parties and civil society, nobody has told us anything or any possibility of meeting his envoys. If they are serious about assisting in this political unrest, I mean, they should give similar attention to the voices that are crying. I'm optimistic they will do it, but if they don't do it, we're going to go back to square one.
The democratic reforms that you have been asking for appears to be sharply opposed by the authorities. So what is the next step forward for civil society and political parties, those who are particularly banned from participating in elections in the kingdom?
It's simple, Peter. We will continue with the peaceful protest marches until the power is back to the hands of the people. That one we're not going to stop. Even if it means laying some of our blood down, let it be. Until power is back to the people, we're not going to stop, Peter. But at the end, what we're looking for is a peaceful, genuine dialogue that is facilitated or mediated by international community, not anything that is internally done, maybe by the king and his government, which he can veto where you can veto the product of that exercise. No, we don't want that.
Umbangi Seni Shabangu is the leading member of the PPA and the general secretary of the Swaziland Democratic Party. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. A group of mixed-race women who were abducted as children by state officials in what was then Belgian Congo is suing the Belgian state for crimes against humanity. As Henry Richwell reports, the case comes as Belgium struggles to reconcile with its brutal colonial past.
Leah Tavares Mujinga was born in the Belgian Congo, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, to a white Belgian father and a black Congolese mother. When she was 2 years old, while her father was away, Belgian colonial officials snatched her from her home. Speaking last year, Mujinga described what happened. She told AFP, "They took me away from my mother, who was with me at that time, from my parents' home, to put me in a religious institution in Katende, the Catholic mission of Katende, with the Sisters of St. Vincent de Paul, as they did with other children before me. And my elder brother was also kidnapped a year before me." The state's actions were motivated by race. Mujinga said, if a white man or a white woman marries a black man or a black woman, it is seen as a sin. So the child is considered as a child of prostitution. So that's what we were called, children of sin. Mujinga said she suffered from malnutrition and still bears the physical and mental scars. Thousands of children were taken away from their African mothers by Belgian authorities. After Congo gained independence in 1960, lawyers say they were abandoned. Mujinga is one of five women, now all in their 70s, who suffered that fate as children and are now suing the Belgian government. They are seeking compensation of $55,000 each, a relatively small amount, because if they lose, the women will have to pay a percentage of that sum to the state. The case has much wider implications, says their lawyer, Michel Hirsch. Hirsch told VOA those of mixed race were seen as a threat to the colony, a threat to the colonial system, and also a threat to the supremacy of the white race. And what Belgium, the Belgian state, put in place during colonization was a system to eliminate children. Lawyers say the Belgian state wanted to prevent interracial unions and make sure the so-called Métis children would not claim a link with Belgium in later life. Belgium officially apologized in 2019 for its role in abducting mixed-race children in its African colonies. But Hirsch says it doesn't go far enough. She said the system that was put in place by the Belgian state can be qualified as a crime against humanity because it was a systematic attack against a civilian population, children of mixed race, that is to say for racial reasons. The Belgian state admitted the facts but never compensated in any way. And today, in court, the Belgian state still refuses to compensate. The civil court in Brussels is expected to deliver a verdict within 6 weeks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 22nd. Botswana is processing applications of 100 refugees from the DRC who fled a refugee camp in Zimbabwe, citing hunger. Botswana is home to 700 refugees, mostly from East and Central Africa, who escaped internal strife. From Habaroni, reporter Mkundise Dube has the details.
Minister of Defense, Justice and Security Kagiso Moyo says the refugees' request is under consideration. He says they claim poor treatment in Zimbabwe's Tongokara refugee camp forced them to flee.
Look, some were saying that they're worried about COVID, all those things. But I'm not sure until I get a proper written report. Yeah, but refugee camp. as we always put people and we do the assessments and all that. Then we will consult with the UNHCR and then we'll come up with the final decision.
Mui says they are likely to contact Zimbabwe authorities on the status of the refugees. Most refugees fleeing internal conflict in East, Central or the Horn of Africa use Zimbabwe as a transit route to economically stable countries like Botswana and South Africa. Mui previously said the country was open to accommodating more refugees despite UNHCR reducing aid to host countries.
The government of Botswana agrees that the best durable solution for refugees is for them to return to their countries of origin. We believe that returns must be voluntary, safe and dignified. Returns must be based on the right conditions being in place in countries of origin.
Botswana has repatriated more than 2,000 refugees from Namibia and Zimbabwe in the last 2 years. Mui says his country is pursuing the best future for the refugees.
We recognize the resilience that brings refugees to our doorstep in desperate situations, in many cases unusually traumatized by harrowing experiences before and during their journeys. Botswana has a long history of hosting refugees and providing protection to those fleeing conflict and persecution in their countries of origin.
5 Zimbabweans have taken the Botswana government to court, claiming they face persecution if forced to return to their homeland and worry about their safety. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
A boat with more than 400 rescued people attempting to travel from Africa to Europe is waiting for a safe port to be granted entry into Malta or Italy, but it is getting no response. Sea-Watch 3 rescued more than 412 people in the Mediterranean in less than 24 hours earlier this week. However, Mattia Way, spokesperson for Sea-Watch 3, tells Rikish Trier that the rescue are still waiting for a place to land.
In the last couple of days, we've realized that the situation really deteriorates on board. We've had 3 medical evacuations where in total 6 women had to be evacuated from the ship and are now being taken care of on land. And we realize that every minute the port of safety doesn't come to us really, really makes the situation on board a lot more difficult.
We're in mid to late October right now. This is traditionally the peak or the height of the time when people often take these transportation, try to get to Italy and Malta, etc. Can you tell me about what this year has been like in terms of flows of people?
So I think what is quite interesting is that for the moment now, we do have to realize that with the weather also being a bit rougher, it's going to be more and more dangerous for the people to actually try to cross the central Mediterranean. So there is definitely a need for civil search and rescue organizations to be operative in the central Mediterranean. However, what we realized, especially as we're operating 2 airplanes from the air within this year, is that the numbers of people trying to cross is getting bigger and bigger this year, and it's getting more and more difficult to actually make sure that they are being rescued by European actors. What we've seen in the past is that migration hasn't really become a big issue, and also, for example, in the German politics, we've realized that in the election campaign, it is a topic that really actually is planned to be left out. So what we need to do now is that actually European actors are engaging again in search and rescue operations, that they're not hindering civil search and rescue operations, and that we need to make sure to actually find a solution for the people on the move, that they can reach European shores safely and actually legally, and they don't get criminalized for doing so.
How does that, you know, come about? This has been a struggle for many years.
I think it's quite difficult to answer the question because we've witnessed for 6 years now basically the same situation. It actually has become way worse. So in the last couple of years, basically European actors refuse to do anything about the situation in the Mediterranean Sea. And it's actually something that we can even consider as being wanted from the European politicians, parties, member states.
That was Mattia Way, spokesperson for Sea-Watch 3. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Berlin. 5.9 million people in Somalia require immediate humanitarian help due to the combined impact of conflict, unpredictable climate shocks, including drought, flooding, and shocks such as desert locust crop damage and the COVID-19 pandemic. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
According to UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, more than 5.9 million Somalis need urgent assistance, with 3.5 million of them facing acute food insecurity. Jubaland State in southern Somalia, on the border with Kenya, is the worst affected, as many farmers have lost their crops and many livestock owners have lost their herds due to poor rains. Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble called for urgent assistance to the affected people during an emergency meeting about the situation with some of his cabinet. He said his government has decided to step up humanitarian efforts to save the livelihoods of those affected by the worsening drought in Jubaland Regional State, noting the scarcity of water and food. He said he wants to send his appeal to UN humanitarian agencies in the country and to the international partners as well to also urgently provide help to those affected. Drought is not the only culprit behind the dire humanitarian situation, says Cindy Isaac, OCHA's deputy head of office in Mogadishu.
The humanitarian situation overall has been impacted not only by the drought, but also by the continued threat of the desert locust situation, particularly when we look at Somaliland and Puntland. And this has been further compounded by the impact of COVID-19, but as we all know, the political tensions that have surfaced throughout the year.
According to UN OCHA, funding for humanitarian aid has dipped to its lowest point in 5 years. The UN agency has appealed for $1.1 billion to help Somalia, but only 50% of that figure has been received. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Ghana, where the leader of the continent's football governing body has shared his confidence in the Black Stars of Ghana's ability to rule the world. CAF President Patrice Motsepe, who is on a working visit to the West African nation, believes Ghana is capable of winning the World Cup at senior level. Despite successes at youth stage, the West Africans have only qualified for the Senior World Cup on 3 occasions, their best performance being a quarterfinal finish at the 2010 edition in South Africa.
Ghana can win the World Cup, and there are other countries in Africa that can compete. And we want them also to challenge and win the World Cup. So if you put Ghana and Nigeria and Cameroon and Ivory Coast and Senegal and say compete, look out. The women of Africa may win the World Cup quicker than the men of Africa.
And now to the latest FIFA rankings. Many African nations experienced contrasting movement in the latest rankings released by the World Football Governing Body on Thursday. Senegal, who has already qualified for the playoff round of the World Cup, are ranked first in Africa with 1,564 points. They are closely followed in second place by Tunisia's Carthage Eagles, who dropped 1 point to occupy the second spot in Africa, but 27th globally. Morocco is in third place after moving up 4 places to sit at number 29, overleaping Algeria, who remained 30th and 4th in Africa. Gernot Rouse Super Eagles of Nigeria retained their 5th position on the continent and the 36th spot in the world, having accrued 1,478 points. And now to athletics. Top Kenyan athlete who was killed last week, Agnes Tirop, will be buried at her rural home in Chestnut in Nandi County on Saturday, which coincidentally happens to be her birth date. She will have been 25 years old. The funeral committee, comprising representatives from Athletics Kenya, Nandi County government and the family, have finalized the burial arrangements. Away from athletics now to cricket, where Namibia's cricketers made history with their first ever World Cup win when they beat the Netherlands by 6 wickets at the T20 World Cup in Abu Dhabi on Wednesday. They had to dig deep in the match that went down to the wire, but a brilliant earnings by David Wasey, who scored 66 not out, took them to victory as they reached the target of 166 for 4 wickets, with 6 balls to spare. And finally, in women's football, Liberia Women National Football Team head coach Robert Lauti has apologized to Liberians for his team's home defeat to Senegal in the Women's African Cup of Nations first qualifying round. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, October 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson Omale, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend. Be sure to tune in to Nightline Africa this Saturday and Sunday with Peter Clotty.